Well, please keep your Bibles open at Psalm 73 as we continue through this marvelous personal story together. It's really the testimony of a man called Asaph. And remember, he was a good man. He was a mature believer. In fact, he was in full-time ministry. He was a Levite, and he had been called to minister before the Ark of God. But as we saw last time, he came to a place in his life where he was facing some major problems. He couldn't make sense of what God was doing in the world. He couldn't make sense of what God was doing in his own life, and therefore he'd come to the conclusion that he could no longer see the point in continuing to pursue a godly life. And looking back on this crisis, he writes this psalm under the inspiration of the Spirit, and he shares with other believers, with us today, his story. He's saying to us, "I almost gave up. If I had followed where my mind and my heart was going at that particularly dark time of my life, I have to tell you, I would have let everybody down. I would have betrayed your children." That's what he says, and that's where we got to last time in verse 15. Now, the marvelous thing, as we've seen already, is that God turned this man around. God brought Asaph through this crisis, and he's able to do the same thing for you. We've been saying that Asaph made a five-point turn, and we're coming to the second point of that this morning. Last week we saw, remember, that the turn began for this man when he made a decision. And that decision was to be loyal to the Lord and his people. "I will not betray your children." That was his decision. And when he stopped dead in his tracks, he would no longer follow where his mind was taking him. He committed himself to loyalty to God and to his people. That's where the change began. And we learned last week that really the first step in turning your life around is not finding an answer to your questions. God often calls us to live without answers to our questions. The first step is not finding an answer to your questions. The first step is to make a decision. And that's why we pictured our friend Asaph, who we met last time, holding a stop sign, because that word "stop" really summed up in one word the whole of last week's message. Turning your life around begins when you stop, you make a decision. "I will not betray the Lord." Now, today's message is also summed up in one word. I want to keep this nice and easy so we can remember. Stop was last week. One word for this week: think. Think. Now let's look at verse 16 as we move forward together. "When I tried to understand all this," he says, that's all the problem and all the questions that were going on in his mind, "it was oppressive to me. I looked at these problems in my life. I looked at the problems in the world. And my mind went round and round and round and round and round. I was awake at night. Why is this happening?" I was saying to myself. "It was oppressive to me. I couldn't break free from it. I just couldn't get out." Oppressive. Now, it's a terrible thing when your mind is confused. Goes round and round and round in circles. And the second step in Asaph's recovery, the second point of his turn, was that God straightened out the confused thinking that reigned in this man's mind. Stop, think. Now, how's that going to happen? How does confused thinking that sometimes reigns in our minds get straightened out? I was helped and intrigued by a comment of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones on this. He points out that some Christians have one simple answer for everything. Doesn't matter what problem you present to them, they've got one line answer for everything. They'll just tell you, and you know what they're going to say before they say it: "Just pray about it. Just pray about it. Just pray about it." That's the answer for everything. Lloyd-Jones points out, surely rightly, it's not easy to pray when your mind is confused. If you can't think straight, you can't pray straight. So frankly, when someone says to you or says to me at a point when we're really confused, hey, just pray about it, it's not a lot of help, and you know that, and so do I. Well, Asaph's going to tell us what did turn his thinking around. What did bring him to the place where he could pray meaningfully and clearly. I got to tell you, I found this so practical, so helpful in my own life and experience, and my prayer in coming to this today is that God will use this to bring help and encouragement and the straightening out of confused thinking in our minds and in our hearts today. Look at what Asaph says. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me till I entered the sanctuary of God. Now, Asaph lived at the time of David, and the sanctuary, of course, was the place of worship at that time. Remember, the temple was not built until the days of Solomon, and Asaph's before that time. The sanctuary was where David put the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant was, of course, a large wooden box that was carried on poles, and by the time of David, it was nearly 500 years old. The significance of the Ark of the Covenant, which of course had been constructed in the time of Moses when the people were in the wilderness, was that this was where God had said he would meet with his people. So when God's people were traveling in the wilderness, now nearly 500 years previously, by the time of Asaph, they carried the Ark with them. When they came into the Promised Land, they carried the Ark with them. They came to meet with God when they were in the Promised Land at the place where David put the Ark that was in this tent-like structure called the Sanctuary in Jerusalem. Of course, nobody ever saw the Ark. You remember that. It was kept behind a curtain. So Asaph didn't actually see it, even although he was called to minister in front of it. But the point is that when he went into the sanctuary was the place where the ark was. He knew it was there. The ark was behind the curtain. Actually, that's God teaching us in pictures again, because we draw near to God. We don't see him, but we know that he's there. And God was teaching his people that they could be sure and confident of his presence, even when they couldn't see him, with this imagery of the ark where his presence was promised that was hidden behind the curtain. And of course, that old ark could tell a few stories from the last 500 years. Constructed in the wilderness, carried onto the field of battle, captured once by God's enemies who were absolutely terrified when they saw what happened when they got hold of it. Abandoned on a farm during the lean years of Saul, now it had been brought back to Jerusalem and placed in the sanctuary. It was a box, but it contained three things. You know what was in the Ark of the Covenant? The tablets of stone on which God had written the Ten Commandments by his own finger. A golden pot that was filled with manna, a great reminder of how God provided for his people and brought them through the driest and deadest of times in the wilderness. Aaron's rod that budded, a reminder that God is the God of miracles, and that God has opened a way through the high priest for us to come to peace with him. The ark, in other words, told the story of the promises, the provision, and the presence of God for his people through the centuries in every circumstance of life. Now, there's something very important for us to grasp here. Asaph's confused. He's got all kinds of unanswered questions that are running through his mind. Things are going wrong in his life. His mind needs to be straightened out by the truth. And he's telling us, that's what happened when I came into the sanctuary. Coming to worship is not escaping from your problems. It's coming into an environment where you are faced with God's truth in such a way that you'll be strengthened to face your problems. Coming to worship is not like going to the cinema, where you get about 2 hours relief by being drawn into a temporary kind of world, and then you have to go back to reality again. No, coming to worship is coming into the place where your thinking is changed in such a way that you can go out to face the world in a way that you couldn't have done so before. Now, of course, there are a lot of folks who have the idea that Christianity is really just about aesthetics, that it's about a kind of emotional crutch. This is why Karl Marx said that religion is the, what? The opiate of the people. And frankly, in many cases, he was right. That's how many people use Christianity. They've never really understood what it is. But we do not come to worship for some kind of opiate. We're doing what Asaph does. We come into the sanctuary. We come into the place where we find the presence of God in order to find strength to face the realities of life as our confused thinking gets straightened out by his truth. Now, let's see how that happened for Asaph. It's a wonderful story. Here's the first thing, that as he came into the sanctuary, what he was doing, of course, was remembering God's truth. That is the significance of the ark. The ark was the reminder that God had been walking with his people for 500 years, and in fact, more than that before the time of the ark as well. Here's Asaph, and he's so consumed with these burning questions of what's going on in his own life, he comes into the sanctuary, he sees he's part of something much bigger. God has brought his people through the wilderness. God has kept his people alive in the desert. God brought his people into the land of Canaan and overcame powerful enemies. He has kept his people, he has protected his people, he has guided his people, he has preserved his people, he has sustained his people from generation to generation. And now Asaph comes near to the same ark of God, and he takes his place as a worshiper in this great line of succession. And he remembers that this God is now with him. That's life-changing. I want to read a few lines from one of my very favorite authors, James Denny. He says this, "We need the common faith to sustain our individual faith. We need the consciousness of the children of God in all ages to fortify our wavering belief." And then he says, "To be at home in the church is to absorb this strength unconsciously." And I love this next bit. "It is to be delivered from the shallows and the miseries of a too narrow experience and to be set afloat on the broad stream of Christian conviction which gathers impetus and volume with every generation the saints survive." You see, there's not just your faith, there's our faith. There's not just your experience, there's our experience. There's not just your testimony, there's our testimony. And not just our testimony here in this little capsule of time, but our testimony as part of the testimony of the whole Church of Jesus Christ that's now been going for 2,000 years. You know, it's a great blessing to be part of the body of Christ. There is nothing in your life that God's people have not faced before. There are no questions in your mind that have not been asked before. People have lived and died on the promises of God for 2,000 years. No testing, says the Apostle Paul, has come to you except that which is common to man. There's nothing unique about your pain or mine. To be delivered from the shallows and the miseries of too narrow an experience, says Denny, and to be set afloat on the broad stream of Christian conviction. That's what happens when we gather together in worship, when the church on earth joins with the church in heaven, and I see coming out of my little world that I'm actually part of something far bigger that is in the hand of God. Remember God's truth. Here's the second thing that happened when he came into the sanctuary. What would you expect him to find in the sanctuary? Well, the ark and people. Meet with God's people. Remember God's truth, meet with God's people. That'll straighten your thinking out. The encouragement of God's people is one of the great means that God uses to strengthen us when we feel like giving up. By the way, that is why you should never withdraw from God's people when you're discouraged. See, when we become discouraged, there is a certain impetus that says, hey, I'll just stay home. I'm not going to come to worship. No, I'll just withdraw. And isolation is your greatest danger when you're discouraged. You need others around you. We all do. And Asaph does the right thing. He not only goes to a sanctuary where he finds the presence of the ark that speaks to him of God's faithfulness over generations. He comes to the place where he's going to meet with others who share the same faith and are able to encourage and strengthen one another in God. God will use his people to bring strength and encouragement to you. And sometimes that will happen in the most unexpected of ways. Let me speak personally. Let me tell you how God blessed me last Sunday. Dick Bender. Dick's one of our senior members. He's been through very extensive surgery. He's a man of extraordinary courage. Last Sunday, we just finished the third service. I had my coat on, was about to head out through the main entrance there, head off home, got to the front door of the church, and Dick was there with his stick, about to leave. I hadn't seen him or spoken to him for quite a while. I said how good it was to see him at church after all that he'd been through, and he made some comment about just keep pressing on. I held the door for him, said goodbye, walked across the car park. And here's what I was thinking. If he can do what he's doing after all that he's been through, what in the world do I have to complain about? Actually, I think God was speaking to me through Dick. And he knew nothing about it. The truth is, I've thought about him 4 or 5 times in the last week. I've thanked God for his testimony. And I've drawn encouragement from the example of a man who just keeps struggling on, who wants to be here in worship despite great difficulties. He loves Christ and he just keeps pressing on. So I'll tell you, I'm really glad that Dick made the effort to come to church last Sunday. I don't know what it did for him, but I know what he did for me. Of course, he wouldn't have known anything about it, except that I phoned him. I said, Dick, I want you to know that just seeing you at church last Sunday was a blessing to me. And then I asked him, of course, if it would be okay if I said that this morning. And in true style, he said, "Ah, you can use my name. Just don't go too much on the heroics." See, I see a single mother struggling to bring up her children in the faith, and I'm encouraged without anything being said. I see someone with a child who's seriously ill, and they're trusting the Lord in their difficulties. It inspires me. I see someone who's experienced great loss and they're struggling to hold back the tears, but they're trying to sing because they want to affirm their faith in God, and I'm strengthened. Let me say this especially to some of our older people. You don't know what ministry you have just by your presence, by your smile, by the fact that despite all that you have gone through, you did not give up. Our pastors meet for prayer every Wednesday. Every week we receive a list of folks who are in hospital, confined to home, or enduring some other significant difficulty. It's always printed on a green sheet of paper, so of course we call it the green sheet. I'll tell you, some of the names on the green sheet are an inspiration. All you can do is thank God for some of those folks and pray that you would have grace to be like them. Don't ever underestimate the importance of your staying the course. You are showing the rest of us what it means to persevere. And your faith in these difficulties is part of our testimony to God's grace, and the whole body draws strength from it. Now you see, when Asaph came to worship, he says, I come into the sanctuary, and here's what God did for me. It straightened out my thinking, and how? Because it's here that I'm reminded of God's truth, and it's here that I meet with God's people. There will be a thousand ways in which God speaks from one member of the body to another today. And most of them you may know nothing about. Only God himself knows the full extent of ministry that goes on as the body gathers. I entered the sanctuary of God. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Second, I understood their final destiny. Now, not only, you see, does he remember God's truth and meet with God's people, but he, in the sanctuary, considers ultimate outcomes. I understood their final destiny. Now, of course, Asaph is talking about the final destiny of the wicked. Remember that his whole problem began in verse 3 when he was raising the question of why the wicked prosper. And Asaph uses two pictures here that it seems perhaps God brought to his mind when he was in the sanctuary. God does speak to us in wonderful ways, and he gives us two pictures that describe the ultimate outcome of the wicked. The first is a picture of walking on ice. Look at verse 18. Surely you place them on slippery ground. He's talking about the wicked. Now, why has God placed the wicked, or how has God placed the wicked on slippery ground? The answer is God has placed the wicked on slippery ground by prospering them, which is, of course, the whole point of the psalm. That's where we started. Prosperity is a great blessing, but it is slippery ground. The problem with prosperity, and especially the prosperity of the wicked, is that a man or woman without faith in God who prospers will usually become blind to reality. His money will make him feel secure, and that is a slippery place. Remember the words of Jesus about the man who amassed great wealth and then had marvelous plans for all that he was going to do in the future, and God said to him, "You fool." The strongest of words, "You fool," God said, "don't you know that tonight your soul will be required of you?" Now, if prosperity is a slippery place for the wicked, we'd better take note and realize that it must be a slippery place also, therefore, for the righteous. If God has given you money, be thankful, but also be careful. Be thankful, be careful. It's like walking on ice. It really is. Pride can easily come in when God prospers you, and pride comes before a fall. It's like walking on ice, you see. It's a slippery place. Be thankful, be careful. See, that's why Paul says to Timothy, and notice the strength of this language in the New Testament. This is the apostle speaking to a young pastor. And he says, command those who are rich in the present world not to be what? Arrogant. He's talking about believers here. The danger for the believer who has prospered is what? That he'll become arrogant. And Paul says to Timothy, who's just a young pastor, I've often wondered, how in all the world was Timothy supposed to do this? Command those who are rich? That's what the apostle says. Command those who are rich in the present world not to be arrogant or to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God. Thank God for those who give us a model of that, who provides richly, us richly, with everything for our enjoyment. So he says, I'm thinking about the destiny of the wicked, and I see that it's like walking on ice. They're going to fall over to their ruin. And then secondly, he says at verse 20, it's like waking from a dream. As a dream when one awakes, so when you arise, O Lord, you will despise them as fantasies. Now, it was Augustine, a great Christian writer, who speaks about a beggar who has a dream. He doesn't expand on it. Let me try and paint the picture for you. In the dream, the beggar wins the lottery. $50 million. And in his dream, he sees the home he will buy. He sees the car he will drive. He sees snowmobiles in winter, jet skis in summer. He sees himself flying first class around the world, the Taj Mahal, all the wonders of the world, and all the rest of it. He sees himself cruising the Caribbean. He's dining in the finest of the world's restaurants. But when he wakes up to his horror, he realizes it was only a dream. The reality is he's a beggar. He's a beggar. Now, Asaph's saying, I realize that is the destiny of the wicked. It's a terrible thing to contemplate. Thinking that they have everything, living the dream, they wake up and find they have nothing. To their horror. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. He says, it is to be left utterly and absolutely outside, repelled, exiled, estranged, finally and unspeakably ignored. Now you see, Asaph's saying, I came into the sanctuary, and that's where God straightened my thinking out so that I was able to face life. It happened as I remembered the truth. It's what the ark's all about, as I met with God's people. And as I contemplated ultimate outcomes, and it began to change my whole perspective. I began to say to myself, if that's the end of the wicked, why in all the world am I envying them? And then, of course, he contemplated not only the destiny of the wicked, but the destiny of the righteous. Look at verse 24. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will take me to glory. Now, one of the commentators here points out that there's an interesting parallel between verse 17 and verse 24. If you look at verse 17, then I understood their final destiny. Now, the word translated final destiny literally means their afterward, their afterward. I understood the afterword of the wicked, and the afterword of the wicked is that they fall over and they're ruined and they wake up and they're disappointed. Now, what about the afterword of the righteous? Well, it's in verse 24 and translated with precisely that term. You guide me with your counsel and afterward. You see the parallel. you will take me into glory. This is one of the greatest verses in the whole of the Bible. It describes the whole Christian life. You guide me with your counsel. That's what God does for us now. And afterward, you will take me into glory. What a statement. You will take me into glory. You never know what's going to happen when the phone rings, right? Some years ago, I was sitting at my desk in London, and the phone rang. "Hello," said this voice I had never heard before. "My name is John White. You don't know me? We've never met before. But my wife and I are going to Israel, and we wonder if you'd like to come." Sales call. He continued, though. "We'd like to take you," he said, "my wife and I, if you'd like to come." "Sorry, could you say that again?" Well, John and Rosemary belonged to a church in another part of the country. I'd never met them before. They had a great love for Israel, and they had a great love for the preaching of the word. They had apparently been encouraged, unknown to me, by the ministry, and they wanted to give to Karen and to myself the opportunity of seeing the land where Jesus walked. "We'll make all the arrangements," they said. "You'll just meet us at the airport. If you'd like to come, we'll take you with us." You kind of sit at the end of the phone and say, I've never met this guy. I've never spoken to this guy before. Doesn't happen every day, by the way, but it happened. Well, John and Rosemary were experienced travelers. They'd been to Israel several times before. They knew their way around the country. They took us to Israel. They paid for our trip, and we traveled in their company, and they have become dear, dear friends to this day. They took us to Israel. Now says Asaph, looking up, as it were, by faith into the face of God, he says, "You take me to glory." That means you pay the price of getting me there. That means that I travel in your company. That means you are with me every step of the way. That means when I get to crossing the border with all its hazards and with all its fears, you take me into glory. That's the future. And when he takes you into glory, he's taking you into the place with which he is supremely familiar already. And he will spend eternity showing you its delights to his joy and to yours. You take me into glory. You get your eyes focused on that destiny, the whole of life begins to look somewhat different. Remember God's truth. Meet with God's people. Consider ultimate outcomes. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me. Till I entered the sanctuary. Then I understood their final destiny. So to wrap it up, here's where we've come. Remember, it's a 5-point turn, and there's more to follow. We're at the second point of a 5-point turn, but boy, Asaph's already well on the way. And this is what he wants us to know. "Let me tell you my story," he says. "I was facing these problems. My mind was confused. I'm going round and round and round. I almost gave up. I couldn't even see the point of continuing to pursue a godly life at that time. I had to stop, and I had to think. And I found I couldn't do it on my own. It was oppressive to me. I got nowhere till I entered the sanctuary of God. And I remembered God's truth. I met with God's people. It changed the way I was thinking, and that's where God opened my mind, and I saw the afterword of the wicked and the afterword of the godly. And I'm thinking to myself, I actually thought it wasn't worth it. It changed my whole perspective. It got my thinking straight. Made it possible for me to go out into the world and to face the realities of life. Be transformed by the renewing of your... Let's pray together. Father, some of us want to confess right now the endless cycles of confused thinking that have not been permeated with faith. We have been with Asaph when he says, it was oppressive to me. So thank you for the great privilege of coming into your presence as the body of Christ. Thank you for the truth that our little lives are part of your work for the ages, and even our little church is part of the great company of your people throughout history, most of whom are already in your presence. Fill our minds with your truth. Encourage our hearts through your people. Let us even today in our words minister to one another. And fix our eyes on our destiny, that we may not be those who give up, but rather those who learn with all the church of God to persevere until you take us to glory. For we ask it in Jesus' name.